Well, hi there. My name is Cyrus Habib. I represent you in the Washington State Senate. I was in the State House of Representatives before that. And this is the 48th Legislative District. For those who don't know your legislative district, we are 48, and there are 49 statewide. Our district includes Bellevue, Kirkland, Redmond, Medina, Clyde Hill, Hunts Point, and Yarrow Point. And it's been a tremendous honor for me to represent you in the state legislature. I happen to believe we have the most innovative and exciting, entrepreneurial, and generous district, and it's been a pleasure to get to know you all as constituents. We are about 10 days away from the end of the 2016 legislative session. For those who don't know, our legislative sessions alternate between long sessions in odd-numbered years, like last year, and then shorter sessions in even-numbered years. And so this being an even-numbered year, it's a 60-day legislative session, and we're just about 10 days away from concluding. And so what we do in these short sessions is we will ordinarily continue work on policies that have been introduced. Occasionally, we will tackle new policy proposals. And then we look at the budget that we passed last year, the various budgets, the transportation budget, the operating budget being the largest one, and then the capital budget. And if there are changes that need to be made, either because our costs have gone up, sometimes because of emergencies or for other reasons, or if our revenues are down because you all are maybe, you know, not shopping as much as we'd love you to, but for whatever reason, that causes us to then have to do a supplemental budget, and that's true for all three of these budgets. So that's what we're doing primarily, and our goal is to end on time. I think we're all dedicated to doing that. It's extremely important that the legislature show that it can finish its work on time. So look forward to answering your questions. I'll hand it over to my friend and colleague, Representative McBride.
Well, hello there. I'm so glad that you've called in today, and I look forward to answering some of your questions. My name is Joan McBride, and I'm just finishing my first year in the legislature, formerly mayor of Kirkland, so bringing some local experience a little bit to the table. So I think Cyrus went over kind of where we are in this short session, so I'm just going to hand this over to Patty, and I look forward to your questions. Thanks so much for calling in tonight.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy lives to join us for some important conversation. I'm Patty Cooter. I am the state representative from Clyde Hill, and I am very honored to be your representative. I'm new to the legislature. I was recently appointed in the fall of 2015, filling out former Representative Ross Hunter's term. I've been in the district for about 16 years, a little over actually, and I've seen it grow and change in a lot of ways, and with that, so has some of the issues that face our district. Some of the things that I'm focused on here in Olympia include education, transportation, affordable housing, and other peace and social justice issues, and of course, I care about what you have to say. As your representative, what you care about matters to me, and I look forward to our conversation tonight.
Great. Thank you for that. Again, this is a live telephone town hall with your state lawmakers. If you have a question for your lawmakers tonight, all you got to do is press *3 on your phone. That's *3, and we will get you in the queue. We got a lot of great questions tonight lining up. First, we're going to go out to William, who's got a question about the Voting Rights Act. Go ahead, William. You are live with your state lawmakers.
Hi there. I'm just calling because I'm curious where House Bill 1745, which was exec'd out of the Government Ops Committee, end of last week, and I'm just curious where it's at today. Did it survive, and what is its prospect going forward? Thank you.
So this is Cyrus Habib, and I really appreciate the question. I'm actually the prime sponsor of the Senate version of the Washington Voting Rights Act, which we got passed out of committee last year and was ready and eligible for a floor vote, and unfortunately was not brought by the Republican majority, was not brought to a vote in the state Senate a few weeks ago when that deadline took place. And you're absolutely right that the House Companion, which is introduced by Luis Moscoso, state representative from just north of our district, did make it out of the House earlier this year and came over to the Senate. And I'm on the committee, the Government Operations Committee that you referred to, and we did pass it out of committee. And so it is in the Rules Committee right now, and it is eligible to be brought to the floor for a vote. There's been some amendments to the bill that we hope will make it more appealing to some of the more skeptical Republicans. Just to explain to the other listeners what the Voting Rights Act, what the Washington Voting Rights Act does, this is a bill that, because what one of the phenomena that we've seen around the state is that when jurisdictions decide how to create their internal districts, so a city when it creates city council districts, or a county when it does its county elections and determines its county districts for commissioners or for other elected positions, or port districts or school districts, when they do that, there's often the way that that's been done historically, unfortunately, has not taken into consideration the role that that communities of color have been allowed to play historically and have been deprived of in the districting process in our state. And so the idea here is that if a community of color, let's say, in for example, in Yakima, where there's a large Latino population, but yet until last year, there was not a single Latino elected to any elected position in that entire region, despite them having a huge population, including a majority-minority legislative district, we think that's a problem. And so when the lines are drawn around various districts, we think that there should be an opportunity to contest those lines if they are racially polarized and seek to exclude people of color from choosing the candidate of their choice. Now, normally you solve this with a federal lawsuit, and that's why Yakima, when they lost their lawsuit, we did see really exciting outcome, which was three Latinas elected to the Yakima City Council last year. But we want to pass a state law so we don't have to make a federal case out of this and cost the state taxpayers millions of dollars. So it's kind of complicated, but it's a very, very important bill that we're hoping the Republicans in the state Senate will allow up for a vote this week.
Just to add on, the House of Representatives did pass the voting rights bill but it was completely along party lines.
Excellent. Thank you for that question, William. Again, if you've got a question for your lawmakers tonight, this is a live telephone town hall, a chance for you to ask questions of your state lawmakers. You press *3 on your phone. That's *3. You press that right now, and we'll get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Irma, who's got a question about charter schools. Go ahead, Irma. You are live on the air with your lawmakers.
Yes, I want to know if the charter schools are going to be funded. I know that's before the legislature now.
Yes, thank you for that question, Irma. I sit on the Education Committee where we did have a public hearing on the charter school bill that came over from the Senate. And as I'm sure you can imagine, the bill was debated along policy lines. And funding, as you point out, was one of the main concerns about the bill. There's actually a work group that's been formed that's working on that right now, because the funding source that's been contemplated under the bill is the Operation Pathways, which currently funds scholarships and grants. And there's deep concern as to whether using that funding source is sustainable in the long run dealing with charter schools. So the work group is taking that issue and some other issues with the bill and trying to see if we can come up with a compromise so that we can have a constitutional fix to the charter school issue. And hopefully we'll be able to get that done and not only help our charter school kids, but also help all the kids in our state. As you know, the McCleary decision requires us to fully fund education for all of our kids within the borders, and that's another issue that we're working on too. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you, Irma. Again, if you've got a question for one of your state lawmakers tonight, you just press *3. That's star 3 on your phone right now, and we will get you in the queue. Next, we are going to go out to Helen, who's got a question about parks in Kirkland. Go ahead, Helen. You are live with your lawmakers.
All right, go ahead.
Hi. So I live in Kirkland, and I'm just wondering about the parks. I know they're doing some work on them, but I have a dog, and I'm worried about taking her out to walk. And I know I'm not the only one. So can you help me with that?
Well, I'm no longer on the Kirkland City Council, and I would definitely refer you to the Parks Department in the City of Kirkland. But, you know, most parks are happy to have you and your canine friend walk through and enjoy the parks. For most parks, though, in Kirkland, you need to have the dog on a leash. And so you might want to take a look at Kirkland's dog park that's out in the Totem Lake area. That might be an option for you. It's a wonderful dog park. It's got great terrain. It's got flat areas and hills. So take a look at that. If you go onto the Kirkland Parks website, you'll be able to find plenty of parks. But Kirkland, just like all of the cities in the 48th District, want to be very friendly to not only residents, but to our friends, the canines. So I hope that helps. There's just a plethora of information on the website, and there's also a phone number that you can call and email. So have fun in Kirkland Parks.
Thank you, Helen. Again, if you got a question for your lawmakers tonight, just press star 3 on your phone. That's star 3. We will get you in the queue. Next, we're going to go out to Lily. She's got a question about 405. Go ahead, Lily. You are live with your state lawmakers.
Well, I just don't even know why they have tolls on 405. And regarding the funding of any of the state agencies or whatever, my husband and I are retired. We bought a house in Bellevue in the 70s, and our property taxes, as you know, I mean, they take a quarter of my income. My husband had a heart attack, and so our medical insurance has gone way up, and so has his drugs. And yet we've managed to save some money for a rainy day and cut back and cut back and cut back. And so I don't see any reason why, as much as we already pay for gas, that they should have put a toll on 405, and that they're thinking of raising, getting more tolls. Thank you kindly.
Sure. You know, tolling is a complicated issue, and the decision, by the way, this is Joan McBride from the 48th District. The decision to toll 405 was made over a decade of work with WashDOT and the Transportation Commission, with the cities along 405 from Renton all the way up through Bothell, coming to some decisions around tolling. So tolling the idea for tolling didn't start overnight. It's been a long decision. And what's happened with tolling is while there's all the great engineering in the world, the practical sort of implementation hasn't worked as well as we'd like, and there are some serious problems. As far as the actual tolls, it's surprising what people are willing to pay in order to get into those toll lanes. But given the fact that we don't have another north-south freeway or a place to put a freeway on the north-south, other than 405, there is just nothing on the east side. We have to do something to manage it, because I'm sure you remember before tolling, it was not all that manageable as well, and there were backups that were lasting, up to hours at a time. So there's a lot of problems with the congestion. As far as the price, the legislature has asked WashDOT and the Transportation Commission to look at taking the tolls off on the weekends, and also holidays, and also late at night. So that should give you some relief. As far as the you know, the issues around your property tax, that's kind of a little bit of a different issue. I know that it can be very difficult on your retirement to live in an area such as the 48th where our property values are quite high. But we are trying to make tolling a little bit easier while we figure out these engineering problems. So once again, you should see, I hope very soon, our ability to take the tolling off during weekends, holidays, and then in the late evening. I hope that helps.
And I think it's important that you all be vocal and active in this process. You know, I'm somebody, this is Cyrus again. I'll just freely admit that, you know, I happen to disagree with many in my own party about this issue. I'm just not a fan of what's called express tolling. I think it's, you know, and that's, you know, for those who don't know, that's what we have on 405, where basically you don't toll all lanes. You have general purpose lanes, and then you have lanes that people can buy their way into. And, you know, it's a market mechanism that works. You know, if you want to, if you're flying on Alaska Airlines and you want a little extra leg room, you can pay, you know, some extra money and fly first class. And that's something that works in the private sector. I just philosophically believe that when it comes to public services and public goods and the use of tax dollars to create things for the public, that we should have equity and equality in how those are distributed. And, you know, we would never want, I always make this comparison, you'd never want a situation where if you're studying at UW or Bellevue College and your class, you know, and there's all the biology classes are full, you could just, you know, pay an extra $1,000 and then the wealthier kids could get into bio. So I don't think we should be doing that. That said, as Joan mentioned, this was a decision that was made before the three of us had an ability to stop it. Now that we're here, we should try to reform it, to improve it, to make it work better. And I'm open to looking at whether we move to a completely different way of doing things. And so the more you guys talk about it and discuss it, including, it doesn't have to, you know, you can also tell us when you think it's working. The better, because that'll help us figure out how best to represent you.
But I'd just like to say one other thing. You know, do you remember probably when we told a 520? It took a good 6 months for people to settle down. I don't know if you recall, but there was a lot of chatter on the TV. A few mayors were very concerned. We need to see if this issue is going to settle down as well. We need to give it some time. We need to reform and then reevaluate, because the work that's gone into tolling, it's millions of dollars. It's being used throughout the country in different places with success. So where there are problems, we need to fix them, and then we need to see if it can work, and if not, you know, then we have to have another conversation. But it's not something that we can stop on a dime. Thanks for your question.
Yeah, and this is Patty Cooter, and just to follow up on what my seatmates have been saying, first of all, I want you to know that how you feel about the tolls, you're not alone. I've received many, many, many emails about the tolls on 405, and coupled with your other financial issues, I can see why it's of real concern, and I appreciate that you took the time to call in and talk about it. You know, it is something that we're taking very seriously here. I know the chair of the Transportation Committee has taken it very seriously as well. We've met with WSDOT, delegation of us from districts along the 405, to ask for some immediate relief to help people in your situation. And the governor has listened, and changes have already been made and implemented, non-legislative fixes at this point. And it's something we do need to look at, and I agree it's something we need to make it work for everybody. And that really will come as we sort through the rest of the issues. But I really appreciate the call, and I want you to know that, like I said, you're not alone in this. There's a lot of people who feel the way you do.
Yeah, thank you, Lily. Again, for those that have a question tonight, just press *3 on your phone. That's *3 right now, and we will get you in the queue. Next, we are going to go out to Cynthia, who's got a question about children's mental health. Go ahead, Cynthia. You are live
Hi.
With your lawmakers.
Yes, thank you very much. I want to thank Joan McBride and Patty Cooter for the House positive vote on the Children's Mental Health Bill. I understand that it is now in rules in the Senate, and I don't believe that you, Cyrus, are on the Rules Committee, but I wondered what you thought the chances are of getting it out of committee and onto the Senate floor to be voted on.
Cynthia, thank you for the question, and thank you for all of your. By the way, I recognize every one of my constituents by voice. There's 140,000 of you, and so Cynthia, thank you for your leadership with the children's with fighting for the Children's Alliance and Children's Campaign Fund. That bill needs to come to a floor vote. We still have a week, and we've just now. Just starting tomorrow, we'll be on the floor bringing bills. There's a Rules Committee meeting tomorrow to bring bills to the floor. The Senate majority has been doing package pulls of bills, so they've been pulling large numbers of bills to the floor. So I'm still very optimistic. I think it's wonderful that it made it out of its policy committee. And so fingers crossed. I think I feel very good. I think it passed with a bipartisan vote in the House as well. So I think
it did.
Yeah.
This is Joan McBride. Cynthia, thanks for your kind words, and I'd like to just second Cyrus's words. Thank you so much for all the work you do. It's making a real difference here in Olympia and in our state.
Again, folks, star 3 if you've got a question tonight. Next, we're going to go out to David, who's got a question about transit, Metro Transit. Go ahead, David. You're live with your lawmakers.
Hi. I don't know if this is a question that should be directed toward Metro itself or if it's something that you can do, but I'm 60 years old and I have bad knees. I walk with a cane. And what I've noticed is a lot of places where there's a bus stop. I'm not talking about a rapid ride. I'm talking about a regular bus stop where there's just a pole in the ground. They don't have benches where you can sit down and wait for a bus. If I have to stand for more than 10 minutes or 15 minutes, my knees are killing me. It would really be nice if there was a bench at every bus stop where you could sit down and wait for a bus. Is this something that you guys can pass an ordinance for, or what is the best way to ensure that something like this gets taken care of?
David, this is actually a problem, and sometimes this is Joan McBride again. So what I'd like you to do is, when this call is over, I'd like you just to kind of stay on the line and give your name and some contact information. And where you catch the bus at your home, maybe we can see about getting a shelter or getting a bench put up there, because this is really sort of Metro's, this is Metro's sort of business. We can work a little bit on that, and I would be happy to work with you next year on that, because I think accessibility to the buses is a very big issue.
You give him your email so he doesn't.
I'll take it when.
Okay. Yeah, you can also, and I'm sure the hosts and the moderators will tell you this at the end of the call, but for those who are going to have dinner or may drop off the call, just know that you can email us, and our email addresses are all the same format. It's firstname.lastname@ledge, which is L-E-G, which we pronounce ledge, but is leg, .wa.gov. So mine is cyrus.habib@leg.wa.gov, and same with joan.mcbride or patty.cooter. So that's always a way to email us, and you can also just Google our names, and our state legislative websites will come up. If you email us those questions, and I agree, David, I think you should. For those who don't know, I have a disability myself. I'm visually impaired. It's very important, and I think any one of us would be happy to help, as would Claudia Balducci, who is the King County Council member in our area, and I know that that's an important issue for her as well.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you, David. Again, star 3 if you've got a question for your lawmakers tonight. Sticking on the transportation theme, we're going to go out to Steve, who's got a question about bicycles. Go ahead, Steve. You're live with your lawmakers.
Hi. It's my understanding, although I can't quote any college studies, but when you invest in buses as opposed to light rail, say a corporation comes into an area, you can put in more buses. Somebody builds a large apartment complex, you can add buses. You know, let's say the large apartment complex is a mile from any kind of light rail, or 3 or 4 miles, you can just add buses that go there. So they're more flexible. Also, bike lanes. People who are riding bikes have less health problems. You're getting them out of their cars. The investing to reduce traffic by using buses and bike lanes improves public health and reduces congestion at a fraction of the cost of large infrastructure projects. Now, large infrastructure projects produce a lot of money that can then be flowed into, you know, I mean, there's re-election campaigns and things like that. So what I'd like to see is investments that actually function as opposed to what helps promote a culture of selfishness based on the cost of the project as opposed to the effectiveness of the project.
I'm sorry, what was your first name?
They dropped him off.
Steve, thanks, Steve. So the House did pass a transportation budget that had the biggest non-motorized budget the state has ever seen. So that's a big first step. And I know in my caucus, by the way, this is Joan McBride. I know we're having a conversation, but I should introduce myself as well. So it was a robust, big, non-motorized commitment. So I think you will see quite a bit of that over the next coming years. The other thing is, you know, most of the cities in our 48 district and the surrounding districts, they themselves, through local monies collected, et cetera, have made big investments in non-motorized. You see a lot of bike lanes and corrals and et cetera when in all of our cities throughout the 48th and especially also in Seattle. So major investments are being made by the state and by the localities as well as, you know, our county. King County is making a lot of investments too. You and I might disagree a little bit about buses and the importance of transit. In fact, most of the folks I know who are bike commuters sometimes will actually even use a bus or transit for part of their bike commute. But I definitely agree with you that biking is one of the safest and most healthy way we can move about in our community. So I'm glad that sounds like you're an avid biker and, you know, pedal on, sir.
Steve, hi, this is Patty Cooter, and I just want you to know, too, that at least from the 48th all the way into Seattle, once the 520 is open, there's going to be a beautiful bike lane that will be significantly improved over what you have probably experienced on I-90. It's much wider. There's going to be bump outs for pedestrians to get out of the way, so there'll be less pedestrian bicycle interaction, and having it hopefully it will be over by the Microsoft campus all the way through into Seattle should be a real boon to those people on both sides of Lake Washington that really enjoy biking and getting to work that way and getting off the roads. So. Just to give you, I took the tour of it, and I can tell you you're going to be very impressed once you ride it for the first time.
Also on the east side, Steve, we have the East Side Rail Corridor, and through Kirkland you can ride now a bicycle, but soon we hope to see all 40 miles of that open to bikes as well.
So this is Cyrus, and I wanted to take on part of what Steve was just mentioning about light rail, and I... And I want to kind of correct a misconception. So some people think that politicians enacted Sound Transit and light rail, and I think Steve was under the impression that we do that so that we can get campaign contributions. So first of all, that Sound Transit's a public agency and doesn't make campaign contributions to anybody. But secondly, we're actually not the ones that have approved Sound Transit or Sound Transit 2, or who will be in a position to approve or reject Sound Transit 3. That's actually the voters. Mm-hmm. So all of us as voters in, you know, Pierce, King, and Snohomish have voted for every single time Sound Transit has ever been expanded. Every inch of light rail has been approved by taxpayers voting themselves to do it. So there's no politicians forcing it on anybody, and certainly no politicians getting campaign contributions. Trust me, we'd all know it if that were true. So I think it's very important. But here's the thing. I mean, what you're hearing from all of us is that these things are, trust me, as somebody who's blind, you don't want me driving, right? So I'm a big fan of lots of different non-automotive transportation options. But to do that in the right way, we need a sophisticated set of choices. So for some people, that's going to be biking. For some people, that's going to be taking the bus. As Joan said, for some people, that might be a combination or a hybrid of both. And for some people, that's going to be trains. And I'll tell you what, I challenge you to find me a cosmopolitan, successful, economically prosperous city on the planet that doesn't have a functioning commuter train system. There's not one. And that's why, you know, when you look at San Francisco, you look at New York City, you look at Boston, you look at Chicago, you look at D.C., or overseas, they have these systems. We are just in the baby stages of doing this right now. But for the major routes, it is so important that we get people off the roads and even buses off the roads, and that we get large numbers of people who need to go from the airport to downtown, from UW to downtown, from Bellevue to Seattle, these major things that we know are predictable, to Microsoft, so on, that we get those things done in a predictable way. And that's what light rail is, part of the mix to make everyone's commute a lot better on the road because you're taking people off the road. So thank you so much for your interest in having a multi-tiered transportation system that gives everyone choices.
Thank you, Steve. Again, just a reminder, *3 if you've got a question for your lawmakers tonight. Next, we are going to go out to Mary Ann, who's got a question about homelessness. Go ahead, Mary Ann. You're live with your lawmakers.
Hi. I'm a volunteer with a group called the New Bethlehem Project that is trying to open a day center for homeless families on the east side. And I just recently read about the count that is done of homeless people in January and learned that there was an 83% increase in homeless people on the east side. So both of these things have been upsetting me, and I was very happy to see the $60 million that's been earmarked for the homeless crisis. And so I just wanted to thank you for that and maybe learn a little.
Thank you very much, Mary Ann, for those kind words, and thank you for what you're attempting to do around homelessness in our district. It sounds like you might be working in our district. So I can tell you that in our caucus, in the Democratic caucus, all of us are working on issues around homelessness. I myself ran 8 different bills that either dealt with affordable housing or homelessness. And that's in addition to a health care bill for students who are homeless. We are all trying desperately to begin to address this problem in a more holistic way, in a way that has sustainable funding. So I think we've got some money now set aside. We just need the Senate now to agree that we need to spend this money. So I'm hopeful that the Senate will do the right thing and pass the House's budget with that additional money for homelessness and affordable housing. But thank you very much for the work that you're doing.
Yes, Mary Ann, this is Patty Kudu. Thank you very much for what you're doing. You are absolutely right. We have got a real problem on the east side with homelessness and with lack of affordable housing. And Joan accurately described what we've been doing, what we've budgeted, I guess, for the homeless crisis out of the House, and we do need the Senate approval on that. But I wanted you to also know that we've also budgeted $6 million to improve the lives of foster kids who also can find themselves dealing with homelessness issues as well. So I just wanted to let you know that those are issues that we very much care deeply about in the Democratic caucus, and you know, your support, contacting people in the Senate and encouraging them to support this would be really, really helpful. So thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Marianne. Again, *3. That's *3 on your phone right now if you've got a question for your lawmakers. Next, we're going to go out to Eric, who's got a question about Medicaid coverage. Go ahead, Eric. You are live with your state lawmakers.
Thank you. Cyrus, it's nice to see you Thursday. I was down on Senior Lobby Day. I'm sorry I missed Joan and Patty. Following up on the budget item Medicaid coverage for hearing aids, not a big deal, but I didn't get really a lot of positive reply. What we're seeking is $600,000 from the general fund, which will open the doors for $2 million federal match to kind of reinstate that coverage, which was cut in 2010. Thank you.
So thank you for visiting us and for bringing this issue up. So Friday morning, when we began debating the proposed budget that came from Senate Republicans, that did not include the restoration of funding for not only hearing aids but also vision hardware, glasses. I introduced an amendment on the Senate floor to restore that money and to in my view to improve the Senate Republican budget. And on a party line vote, the Republicans turned it down. And Senator Andy Hill from the 45th Legislative District spoke against it and said that this was not the right year to be talking about those issues. And, you know, what's concerning about that is that at the same time, part of what the Republican budget in the Senate does is it also discontinues health care under managed care for a category of the most vulnerable people in our state called aging, blind, and disabled, and instead puts them on a fee-for-service insurance model. So they're going to be getting notices to say that they're not eligible to stay on their managed care Medicaid service provider and payer. And I don't think it's sufficient consolation to say that they won't be able to read that notice because they won't have glasses. But this is really a kind of a mean side of this budget that Senate Republicans have passed out. They also fail to restore money for the ombudsman program for the elderly. So when we have elderly, when you have seniors in nursing homes and adult family homes, we'd like to have an independent ombudsman go and evaluate and do check-ins to make sure that these individuals aren't being neglected or even worse, being abused. And those have been cut systematically. And so we also introduced an amendment trying to restore that money, which again, Senator Hill spoke against and the Republicans voted down on a party line vote. So some of these things around health care and the most vulnerable were really, really striking to me because we you'd be surprised to find ways in which when it comes to doing some tax incentives or loopholes, somehow the money is found. But when it comes to taking care of the disabled and the elderly, this isn't the right year. So I'm going to keep fighting. I know the House is going to fight on this issue as well. And as somebody who went through challenges with his eyesight, and I care a lot about making sure that people whose eyesight and hearing we can improve with some very simple help are able to do that, even if they're poor.
So I want you to know, this is Joan McBride. I want you to know that on the House side, my office did the proviso for the for the recovery of the hearing aid funds, the $600,000. And we also, both Representative Cooter and I, made sure that the money for the restoration of the Ombudsman Program, the $175,000, was included, and indeed it was included in the House budget. It just didn't make it through the Senate.
Yeah, and Eric, this is Patty Cooter. I want you to know that one of the very first forums I went to was in Kirkland on aging and the elderly. And there were many people there who were hard of hearing or deaf and had this and raised this issue about the lack of being able to have Medicaid pay for hearing aids. And the cost of hearing aids can be prohibitive for the elderly in particular. And I was a strong proponent of including that coverage back in. And like my colleagues, I'm going to continue to fight for that, too. It's just simply the right thing to do.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Eric. Thank you for that question. Again, star 3 if you've got a question for your lawmakers tonight. I've got time for a few more questions here. So next we're going to go out to Jess, who's got a question about the carbon tax. Go ahead, Jess. You're live with your lawmakers.
Thank you. I've never done this town hall before, and it's great. So, Mr. Habib, thanks for your leadership on climate change. I was interested in what's happening with the carbon tax, the one that is supposedly carbon neutral, whether that is actually moving forward. I know there's an alternative bill that the proponents came and tried to correct something, and I'm just kind of ignorant on what's going on with it, and I'd really love to be informed about what's happening with that. Thanks.
So, well, thank you so much. So just for the for those who may not be keeping track of the various proposals out there, there's a ballot initiative that is qualified. It has received the requisite number of signatures to qualify for the ballot, but it's actually an odd thing called an initiative to the legislature, which means it first makes a stop at the state legislature, and then if we don't act, then goes to the ballot like a normal initiative. That's called Initiative 732. It is a revenue-neutral carbon tax, a term that's somewhat controversial because it's not clear that it will be revenue-neutral for any length of time. What it does is it creates a tax on carbon pollution, and then offsets that tax by a tax cut on all the rest of us in our sales tax by a penny, which if you did that right now, depending on who you ask, would be roughly a neutral swap. There's some debate about whether it'd be exactly neutral or it'd be slightly negative, but it would not be a huge difference one way or another. The challenge is, what happens down the line, and what happens if we end up doing some really good things, some really smart things to reduce carbon pollution. For example, if we expand solar or electric vehicles and infrastructure for electric vehicles, well, all of a sudden then, it's not like the sales tax comes back up. The carbon tax revenue would just go down based compared to what was projected. And so you'd start to see real problems in the budget around you know, again, we'd have problems with paying for hearing aids, right? And we'd have difficulty paying for all-day kindergarten and things like that. And so, you know, we'd like to have a fiscally sound plan for fighting carbon pollution. And so I was a fan of and I was the sponsor of the governor's cap-and-trade proposal last year that would have helped us with our education and transportation investments and also curbed the effects on climate change that are created by carbon pollution. That plan has stalled out, and so we're just going to see. I mean, one of the reasons why the revenue neutral plan was supposed to be more attractive was that it was supposed to gain Republican support. Many Republicans have publicly said, I want to fight climate change, but don't raise taxes. If you do it in a way that doesn't raise taxes, I'm all in. And so what we've asked the proponents to do is to show us, to call that bluff and to see if we can get some support from Republicans on this proposal. We've not gotten that yet, and so I'm not hugely optimistic that anything like that will come out in the next 10 days, but let's wait and see.
Excellent. Thank you for that. We have an online listener, and that would be Nancy from Bellevue, who's got a question from for the members tonight about prescription drug costs. I'm wondering if the legislature has any plans to address the high cost of prescription drugs.
Hi, Nancy. This is Patty Cooter. Thanks for the call. Oh, and your question?
Oh, I'm sorry. That was an email that came in. This is a listener
okay,
who's listening
you,
to us online. Yes, I apologize.
All right. Well, thanks for that. So we had today in General Government Information Technology, we had a fairly long and detailed public hearing on pharmacy benefit managers and the effect of the cost of drugs and whether or not there should be some restrictions put in place to help with that. Currently, right now, under the system, the pharmacy benefits managers negotiate with the healthcare insurance companies for a price that's higher than what they charge the pharmacist. So, in other words, The pharmacy benefits managers are making a profit between what they charge the health insurance provider and the pharmacist. And the issue is whether or not we can shrink that profit so that we can address the issue of the high cost of prescription drugs. And without knowing more about what the exact issue is with respect to those prescription drug costs, if we're talking about what happened with, Mr. Shkreli out in the East Coast, where he took a drug cost, and one day it was $15 a pill, and he raised it to $750 a pill, that's a different issue, and that is being handled at a federal level, is what I understand, and that there is federal legislation in the works that is supposed to be restricting the ability of companies like his to do that.
So I've introduced, this is Cyrus, and I want to thank Nancy. I've introduced legislation that's the first of its type in Washington State. It's called, it's commonly around the country known as cap the copay legislation. And if you Google, or I suppose in deference to Microsoft, we should say Bing, my name and cap the copay, you'll find information about the bill and news articles about it. But look, as someone who's a three-time cancer survivor, I know that chemotherapy costs and drug costs related to MS and autoimmune disorders, lots and lots of specialty drugs is what they're called, are costing people who have insurance. We're not talking about people who are uninsured. But people with insurance are paying hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars a month in health in copays. They've actually come up with a new term for it. It's called co-insurance, where instead of paying a $15 copay, you actually are on the hook for 20% of the cost of the drug. Well, that's fine if you know you're talking about amoxicillin, right? But it's not fine if you're talking about an autoimmune disorder where the drug can cost as much as $3,000 a month, and so you're paying 20% of that. And so what this bill would do is it caps the amount that the insurer can pass on to the customer to $100 per month for a particular drug. And I still think that's high. But this has been done in California, it's been done in Maryland, it's been done in other states, even in states controlled by Republicans, and so it's common sense legislation. It's a short year, and so it will not be a piece of legislation that's going to make it to the governor's desk this year, but because of Nancy questions like yours, because of Patty and Joan working on this in their committees in the House, my hope is that we can do something at the state level, even as the federal government does what it can.
Great, and thank you for that question, Nancy. Next, we're going to go out to Daisy, who's got a question about stoplight cameras. Go ahead, Daisy. You are live on the air with your lawmakers.
Yes, I live in Bellevue along 148th Avenue in Lake Hills area, and I've noticed that people are really speeding towards the main street and the Bellred, maybe trying to avoid the flashing red light. I mean, you know, when you get the camera, you have to smile, and $124 ticket will be at your door next time. So my question is, how is this working for all of us? Is this an effective way to catch violators, or and the money that we have collected, where is this money being used to fund what? If you can, you know, just give me some, you know, any input or insight about this. Thank you.
Sure. Hi. So I think your name, it was Daisy, correct? So Daisy, you know, the red light cameras are fairly controversial, and they're not allowed in a lot of different places. Often they're around a school zone, et cetera. But, and they are highly effective. They are very, very effective at catching folks who go through red lights. The problem is that maybe they're a little bit too effective. People get very upset, and a lot of people will get dinged. But however, as far as the funds that are raised from the tickets, those all go into the maintenance of the equipment, of the red light cameras, and the rest of it goes into public safety. With, I don't think there's an exception to that throughout our state. They're effective, they're highly controversial, and they need to be calibrated in such a way that they are not catching people that are just on the very limits of running a red light. So how they're calibrated is important. It's important that the money goes to public safety. And then it's important that they're near school zone areas. Thanks so much for your question.
Daisy, this is Patty Cooter. I just want to follow up on Representative McBride's comment. She's right on all accounts, and I just want you to know there's also another reason that, I mean, the red light cameras are actually used by investigators and sometimes attorneys like myself when we're looking for evidence in an accident situation. And I had one where I got that video, which helped me in a case involving a drunk driver who hit my client. So they have another purpose, too. I just want you to know, a public safety purpose in there, too.
Great. Thank you, Daisy, for that question. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions tonight. If you wanted to ask a question, but we didn't have time to get to you, just hang on the line for a few more minutes. Just about a minute or so, we'll give you an opportunity to leave a voicemail for your lawmakers that will be routed to them after tonight's call and their staff. Again, thank you for participating in tonight's call, and I'll turn it over to the lawmakers for some brief closing remarks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And to everyone out there who called in, this is Joan McBride. I want to wish you a very good evening. Thank you so much for calling. Your questions were thoughtful, and I hope that our answers were able to be helpful for you. Thanks again.
Thank you. This is Patty Cooter. I really appreciate that you took the time out of your lives to call in tonight. And as I said in my opening comments, your opinions matter very much. And please stay in touch, and you know, feel free to visit me here in Olympia or at the district office in Bellevue. Thanks again for calling.
And this is Cyrus Habib. You know, I just love this district. Thank you guys for giving me this tremendous privilege to work on your behalf. And you know, in a time where when you turn on the TV and you see the negativity in the public sphere and in politics, to me, when we find opportunities to do in-person town halls, to do these telephone town halls, when you all are able to make it down here to the Capitol, or when we're back, as we will be starting in 10 days, back at home, and you come and meet with us at a coffee shop, you know, that's really why we do this, and that's what this country is all about, and that's what democracy is all about. So it's wonderful to have this opportunity to connect with you guys, and even though it's February 29th, let's not make this an infrequent thing. Let's do these kinds of things more often. Thank you all, and have a great evening.